as Dean describes the process, especially in its academic form, I just think of all the things that we go through, that they do for us as police officers, the training they send us to. This is exactly what we're doing. I just got back from a seminar. It was a two-day thing that they send every police officer, or that's their goal. So far, I think they've sent some 40,000 cops in the state of California to Tools for Tolerance in Los Angeles. It's the Holocaust Museum, and they use the Holocaust of Nazi Germany as the setting or the theme of their Museum of Tolerance. It was a horrible thing that happened in Nazi Germany, but then they launch using that as a pretext to teach tolerance. And they move way beyond just racial discrimination, and they get into how you have to accept the deviant. You must accept everything and anything. If you have a rigid set of rights and wrongs, black and white, like the social psychologist said, then you are a fascist. You are a potential fascist. You are just a Hitler in waiting. You're just another brown shirt, an SS officer. And so for 2 days, they drilled us for that. And then we'll have another four-day session on diversity, and on and on and on. When I first became a police officer, I had the privilege, back in the 1980s, of working with an older generation of police officers. And I learned from some of the best. I'm fond of my very first lieutenant, who's now retired. You get a star for every 5 years you've been on the department. They put it on your name tag, at least in the San Diego Police Department. Right? He had so many stars, they were falling off his name tag and going down his sleeve. I mean, the guy had been around, you know, since dirt was invented. By the time I came on, he was waiting to retire. I was new. I wanted to get out there and get in the action, do all this stuff. And he'd call me, especially in third watch, he'd call me into the office and just, I don't know why he liked to chat with me. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, he'd call me in and, oh, gosh, I'm in trouble. What did I do now? And I'd go in there and he'd say, you know, Phil, I'm thinking about getting this truck, you know, but it's 3 feet longer than my garage. And he'd start talking about how, you know, should I get this truck or should I enlarge my garage or, you know, what should I do? Should I get the smaller truck or a bigger garage? One of the stories he told me was when he first came on, he liked to wax, liked to tell war stories and things. And he'd say, when I first became a police officer, he says, I showed up for the first day of work. And I had my uniform like they instructed me to do. And I checked in with the duty lieutenant, and he said, gave him a gun, gave him a badge, and says, okay, your beat, you got a walking beat. And he gave him the parameters, like a 4-6 block parameter. And he said, have fun. And he stood there with a badge and a gun. No training, no academy, none of that stuff. Didn't tell you how to shoot straight or drive a car and not so straight. And he said, well, you know, what do I do? I'm a police officer now, what do I do? And he says, the duty lieutenant said, he looked at him and said, he says, you know the difference between right and wrong, don't you? Lieutenant James said, yeah, I think I do. He says, well, you go find somebody that's doing something wrong and bring them to me and I'll tell you what to put them in jail for. And that's a very simplistic view of the world, perhaps, but it illustrates the difference of where we're at today. Now, obviously, the professionalization of the police department was a necessary change that had to come to police work through the 60s and 70s. But they also introduced a lot of this social psychology stuff along the way. We're going to talk about some of that today. Primarily, the COPS program. It's an acronym. It stands for Community-Oriented Policing Services. This philosophy really developed throughout the 1970s and into the 1980s. It was adopted by some of the larger police departments, including the San Diego Police Department in the mid-1980s. But it became a federally funded official program in 1994. Bill Clinton introduced the COPS legislation. You know it, or you might know it, as the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994. It was popularly advertised as the 100,000 cops program. Bill Clinton promised 100,000 new cops for the streets of America. We're going to make it all safe. And of course, that sounds good. Boy, we're going to get 100,000 new cops. We're going to control crime. We're going to have safer neighborhoods, less graffiti, fewer gangs, and all that sort of thing. Sounded good. They always sugarcoat these evil programs, and this is nothing but evil, if I can use that term. What it was sugarcoating, the fine print was, it was also to promote the implementation of community policing. It's a philosophy, and I'm going to outline that philosophy for you. The U.S. Department of Justice, the DOJ, administers this program. The DOJ created the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS. like I said, the San Diego Police Department, of which I am a member, adopted this program, this philosophy. The father of community policing is a guy named Dr. Trojanowicz out of Michigan State. He has connections back to Kurt Lewin and such. We'll talk about Kurt Lewin again. He moved the Institution for Social Research, originally founded in Frankfurt, Germany. We'll talk about that. It went to MIT and then benchmarked off and went to University of Michigan. So Trojanowicz was not a police officer. He had no law enforcement expertise, yet he cooked up this philosophy, very sophisticated philosophy of how to do police work. It was not traditional police work. It was not the kind of police work my lieutenant and I grew up on and we were weaned on, where it was black and white. You know the difference between right and wrong. You find somebody doing something wrong and you catch them and you throw them in jail. It's not like that anymore. 29 states established regional community policing institutes. I've attended this institute on numerous occasions for training. I will show you some of the training materials, just some samples, because there's an ocean of it. Here is a definition provided by the Department of Justice. This is not the complete one, but it's just like the first two sentences of it, but that's all we need for today. It is a shift in philosophy about police duties versus community responsibilities to a team concept of total quality management of the community. This is federal stuff. This is official community policing definition. And right away, you should notice that there is a shift going on. There is a change taking place. They're vague and ambiguous about it, because if they were specific, you wouldn't buy it. We got to promote it with saying, we're going to promise you 100,000 new cops. That was a lie. There are not 100,000 new cops. There's not 50,000 new cops on the street of America. I doubt if there's 25,000. It was funded by Congress in 1994 to the tune of almost $9 billion, and it was re-upped again for several more billion dollars. They're cutting back on the program now because it's been implemented. They don't really need to spend so much money. Why so much money? I mean, that's a tremendous amount of money. It's really to implement this philosophy. It's not to add cops. There was just a shell game of who was doing what. And there was no new bodies. It was a lie. It's to do this. It's to shift to a team concept of total quality management. And I am going to define what TQM is for you today. Of the community, not with the community, but of the community. Whatever TQM is, the COPS program is going to be some kind of a total management of the community. Re-identifying the role, the police role, as a facilitator in the community. So now we're going to not only shift the philosophy of police work, the role of the police officer in your community, your local police officer, whatever it was, they don't define what traditional policing was. The new role is being a facilitator. What in the world is a police officer going to do as a facilitator in your community? Continuing the definition, the leaders of the community, their definition, by the way, and they list these. This isn't mine, this is their words. Law enforcement, government, business, education, health, civic, nonprofit, medical, religious, etc. They don't leave, I don't know if there's anybody, any identifiable group in your community that is left out of this. So the leaders in the community, including the police, are going to collaborate to identify problems in the community. That sounds good, doesn't it? We're all going to get together and we're going to, what are the problems in our community? And we're going to solve them. We're going to suggest solutions to those problems. Part of this is we're going to have, I've broken it down into these elements right here, trying to make this as simplistic as I can, because it can get kind of complicated. You've seen a change. A change is coming. What kind of change? Whatever total quality management is, we're going to discuss that. It has to do with, it comes out of this animal called general systems theory. And I will outline that for you. And the police officer is going to be a facilitator. Just like Dean explained that the teacher in the classroom is no longer going to teach facts. Here are the facts. Take a test. Either you're right or you're wrong. Kind of like my lieutenant. Right and wrong. Kind of black and white. Now the educator in the classroom is going to be a facilitator. Well, the police officer is now going to be a facilitator in your community. Isn't that nice? Doesn't that make you warm and fuzzy? And of course, they're going to do this thing called problem solving. Now, doesn't all that sound so positive? It sounds so good. We're going to take your tax money and do it. So, we're going to explain these four things in excruciating detail. I'll cut right to the chase. This is Marxism. you would not in a million years, the average Joe on the street, including me when I first saw it, I knew something was queer about it. It was just a, it just like petting a cat the wrong way. You know, the cat doesn't like, it's uncomfortable, doesn't know why. But this whole thing, I came to find out later, it is Marxist. Most people don't know what Marxism is. They're not familiar with the philosophy of Marx. If I said, that's communist, you'd think of a hammer and sickle, or Red Square, or Lenin, or, you know, you'd think of images or things, but you're really not familiar with the concept. What is Marxism? Well, it's dialectical materialism. They love these complicated words that just, you don't even know what they're talking about right off the bat. What in the world is dialectical materialism? This is it, right out of the dictionary. Simple, you can just go home and crack open your dictionary and look up dialectical materialism. It is a philosophy founded by Karl Marx, which forms the basis of communist doctrine. It combines, it takes two things. It combines the materialistic idea of matter with the Hegelian dialectic in which opposing forces are constantly being reunited at a higher level. The materialism part of it is relatively easy to explain. Marx said, there is nothing outside of our material universe. There's nothing transcendent. There's no heaven, there's no hell, there's no God, there's nothing. In fact, God is here on Earth. It's called society. It's not out there, it's down here. It's just materialistic. That's part of the definition is easy. The Hegelian dialectic, that mouthful, is another thing. What is the Hegelian dialectic? Whatever it is, it forms the basis of communist doctrine. So let's understand that. If I'm accusing our federal government of implementing a communist Marxist doctrine, we should understand what it is. Well, this is a portrait of Hegel. He was a 19th century, lived in the early, he did most of his work in the early 1800s, died, I think, 1833, 39. The dialectic, what is the dialectic, is really not that complicated. Taking a philosophy course or something, you probably run across it somewhere along the line, but it just seems like an abstract concept. What does it have to do with the real world? A lot, as it turns out. Well, the dialectic is composed of two primary elements. Dialectic just merely means oppositions, just opposites. The first component is thesis, and that is position. Just means position, that's all. You have a position of something, on something. The dialectic has an opposing position, antithesis, or opposite position. Simple to understand so far. The concept of the dialectic has been around for a long time. The Greek philosophers like to play with it, and philosophers through the ages, they tinker with the dialectic. When Hegel came along, he did something different with this. It used to be that position and its opposite position were considered mutually exclusive. If I had a position on something, to use a simple argument, if I believe in 2 plus 2 is 4, and an opposite position is 2 plus 2 equals 17, the two are mutually exclusive. You can't get a common position out of that. You can't get agreement on that. So you would argue, my position versus your position. That's what dialectics is. That Aristotelian logic was, you know, your position, we're going to dialogue, and out of that dialogue, we're going to debate the facts and come to which position is the right position. Well, Hegel changed all of that, and when he changed the dialectic, he invented modern man. Schaeffer explains this in his books. Hegel relativized these two positions, and he said, there really isn't any right or wrong position, and its opposite position isn't necessarily right or wrong either. The truth of the matter is to be found in finding whatever common ground, the combination of the two, or the synthesis of the two positions, or what is the common position. How is that so revolutionary? Marx took this idea and ran with it. He materialized the universe. He took the dialectic and said, this is the revolutionary principle in the world. He scornfully talked about all of his predecessors. You know, he was a doctorate, by the way. He was a very brilliant man. He was an evil man, but he was very brilliant. He said, the philosophers have only interpreted the world in different ways. He's saying this contemptuously about his philosophical predecessors. The point, however, is to change it. See, he looked at the dialectic and saw a revolutionary thing there, right? And you're familiar with the terminology, you just didn't know it was related to the dialectic. His idea, of course, this was the essence of Marxism. the dialectic, and it was to change the world, not just to change Germany or Western Europe or Russia. It's global in its concept. To change the world became the warp and the woof of Marxism. And if you hearken back, that was one of the first things we were talking about. There's a change. There's always a change coming with the dialectic. Nothing stays the same. Your position must change. In Das Kapital, he outlines this. Now, you're familiar with these terms. The thesis was the bourgeoisie, the capitalist, the landowner, the upper class, the rich people. And of course, their opposite position was the proletariat. They were the lower classes. Those were the property-less people. They worked and were subjugated by the bourgeoisie. There's this conflict, class warfare. See, he made it an economic thing. You see, the poor people against the rich people, the haves and the have-nots. He saw the dialectic in that, the oppositions, that's what it was. He took that extracted philosophical concept and applied it to society. And he says, this is a revolutionary principle. If I can arouse the lower classes, they can rise up and they can overthrow the dominant class. And the dominant class for him, and he hated him, was the monarchy, the king, the monarchies of Europe at that time, and the philosophical system that underpinned them and supported them, and that was the church. He talked a lot about religion. There were some quotes up here earlier about his critique of religion. But he wasn't just meaning religion in general, although communism seems to try to stamp out all religion. But he meant Christianity in particular. So it was Christianity and the authority structure of the church and the state. It must be overthrown. And we're going to do this through the proletariat, the uprising of the worker. What was the common position? We must eliminate all property. Everybody must have common property or communism. Com is with, like chili con carne. It's the same Latin root. Com is with and unity. With unity, we're going to have all things in common. So you see the dialectic in Marx's basic scheme, you're familiar with the terminology. He said, from this point of view, what point of view? This, the concept of the dialectic and the revolution and the economic model of it. The final causes of all social changes and political revolutions are to be sought, not in men's brains, not in men's better insights into eternal truth and justice, but in the it changes in the modes of production and exchange. That sounds, well, we're just going to change, so we're going to tweak things, make it better. But it was really the overthrow of king and church and the authority structures of the world. It wasn't to happen in here, and it wasn't to happen in here. It was to happen, we just need to change the modes of production. It was an economic thing. He hid his rebellion in a social justice cause. Three main ideas come out of dialectic philosophy. Mutual struggle, that was Marx's favorite term, and Hegel, the unity of opposites, he really liked to say that a lot. The negation of negation. You always kind of tweak your head like one of those dogs that looks at you a little funny. In negation of negation. I'll explain. That's real easy. And then quantity into quality. And the only reason I throw this in here is because we're going to talk about total quality management. What do they mean by the term quality? Well, it's dialectic in its nature, and I'll show you. The mutual struggle portion of it, you have to understand this. The opposites are in conflict. You have not the same position, not the same idea. You have opposing or diverse positions. The more diverse position, more opposite positions in the room, in society, you have diversity. The first thing you think of when you hear the word diversity, you think mostly of race and gender and things like, we're going to have a diverse room. No, this is a philosophical term, diversity. So in their conception of things, diversity is very important. You must have that diversity so you can have dialectic conflict. Then out of this diversity, you have Hegel's terms, the unity of opposites. See how that works? The opposite view of this, it's the world that the Bible presents. It's a didactic universe. It's facts-based. If you have a position that is truth, if it is, it's unchangeable. It's fixed. It is. And this is how God describes himself. The burning bush, he said, I is that I is, if you would forgive my grammar. I am that I am. And anything that is an antithesis to the truth is not the truth. Plain and simple. If 2 plus 2 is 4, it's not anything else. This is a didactic view of the world. There is no synthesis between these two positions. It is diverse, from one another. They drive one another apart. There is no unity in opposites. This is an official poster that is mandated by the city manager in San Diego, is to be in every city office, including the police department. There's one in mine. I keep turning mine upside down, and somebody keeps coming in around it. I think it's my sergeant turns it back. But it says at the bottom, diversity. It brings us all together. And everybody kind of just snickers at it, and we make our little comments stuff, but no one recognizes it for what it is. It is a Marxist philosophical statement in every office in the city of San Diego, mandated by order of the city manager. The second point, negation of negation. I used to go on at length trying to explain this one. Finally, I just threw up a yin and yang symbol. It's that easy. Okay, you have opposites. You see the black and the white. Yin and yang literally means the light and the dark side of the hill. Male and female, good and evil. It's dialectic. But if you notice that each color has within itself its opposite, they're not fixed. They are seen in transition. So as one reaches its apogee, as it reaches maximum, it now has the seeds of its own destruction within it, and then it converts to its opposite. It merges with its opposite. And when it reaches fulfillment, there is the seeds of its own destruction, its opposite. And on and on and on, the negation of negation of negation of negation. This is dialectic. All religions of the world save one is dialectic. All Eastern philosophy is dialectic. But we're primarily concerned with the Western strain of this and Hegel. This is a photograph of my daughter's horse. It says, Daddy, don't you want to take picture of the other end? I said, no, I need this for an illustration. Besides, this is mostly what I deal with at work. Quantity into quality. What is that? Here's another little brain teaser. The tail. The Greek philosophers kind of played with this idea. They said, if I take a hair from a horse's tail, beep, and pull it out, do I still have a horse's tail? And you would say, of course, you dumb Greek philosopher. Of course I still have a horse's tail. And he goes, very good. What if I take another one? The horse probably doesn't like it, but if you keep plucking these hairs, at what point do you no longer have a horse's tail? And you say, this is a stupid philosophical question, not to them. As they said, you see, it's the individual hairs of the horse's tail are quantity, they're individual. But it's only in how they relate to one another that gives it the quality of the horse's tail. So it's how the horse's tail's hairs individually relate with one another to give its quality. So it's not necessarily the individual, but the overall relation to the whole. And this is dialectic also. You see, I have all these opposites, all these individual things, but it's how they relate dialectically to one another that gives it its overall quality. This is what Marx said. It is not individualism that fulfills the individual. It's not the individual hairs that make them distinctive. On the contrary, it destroys him. Society is the necessary framework through which freedom and individuality are made realities, only in a socialist society. So you see, and he also played with that concept of quality to quantity. Only his favorite example was water and the individual degrees of water. If I increase incrementally the degrees in water, at some point I will change its quality from a liquid state to a frozen state or something similar to that. So there's this the idea of dialectic change. Forget the individual, it's the group, it's the collective, it's holistic, it's global. The ideas of Marx kicked around. They started gaining some credence among the intellectuals in Europe at that time. They were really trying to find a place where this could take root. As you know, in 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution, it took root big time. Lenin and the whole Russian Empire fell to this system and to this band of revolutionaries. And at that time, the Marxist intellectuals of that time period thought that, my goodness, this is just the beginning. We just took over a third of the world in one fell swoop. It's now going to sweep through Western Europe. It tried in two places. Germany, they had a little Marxist revolution, but it couldn't gain any traction. This gentleman right here, George Lukács, also spearheaded an effort in Hungary. Hungary and Germany both really tried to have some proletariat revolutions, but they fizzled early on, and some of these revolutions didn't quite gain a foothold in Western Europe like they did in what later became the Soviet Union and Russia. They regrouped, and this man is considered, along with Antonio Gramsci mentioned earlier, the most important Marxist thinker since Marx himself, Marx and Engels. They regrouped this place in Germany, and they got together some of the top Marxist intellectuals at that time. And they said, what happened? Let's evaluate why we failed here and not elsewhere. They came to the conclusion that there was a basic personality type that stood in the way. And they turned to this man for analysis. This is Max Weber, Max Weber. It was his work, Capitalism and the Protestant Work Ethic, that they drew their inspiration. They said it was the Protestant work ethic, the idea of a man working his best to the glory of God. In other words, he's accountable to a higher authority. It was a basic personality type that was diffused throughout Western Europe at that time, that was not present in Russia at the time, that did not predispose him to a revolutionary fervor. And they said, this basic personality type must be undone before we can have a successful revolution. They went back to Marx, and they said, we need to reinvigorate Marx. They took a look at his model, and they changed this. They didn't abandon it, but they changed their emphasis. Remember, from this point of view, what point of view? An economic point of view. They said, it's no longer that. The final causes of all social changes and political revolutions are to be sought, yes, in men's brains. It's going to be a psychological revolution. Before Marx's social domain can revolutionize, we must revolutionize men internally. And how did they do it? Interestingly, they turned to Sigmund Freud. I had come across this in my casual readings. I never could understand why Marxists were so absolutely in love with Sigmund Freud. There was this marriage of Sigmund Freud and Karl Marx. And I thought it was a strange, because on the surface they look like they have absolutely nothing in common. George Lukács got together this band of merry men, and they were a group of Freudian renegades and other misfits in society. But they were important thinkers at the time, and Dean mentioned some of them. Erich Fromm, Theodor Adorno, Kurt Lewin was associated with them. And they gathered at the University of Frankfurt, and they called themselves the Institute for Marxist Research. That was a little too obvious, so they changed their name to the Institute for Social Research. As these guys continued to do their work, they really looked to see how we can do this to Germany. But as you know, history threw a wrench in their plans, and when Hitler rose to power in 1933, they realized the handwriting was on the wall. Most of these guys were Jewish. And all of them were communists. They were Marxists. Two real bad things to be in Nazi Germany. You went to those hideous camps. And interestingly enough, these guys knew the future of that country then, and they fled. They all split. Most of them, unfortunately, came to this country. The Frankfurt School was concerned with two things, Freud and Marx. They were addressing Lukács' basic question, how can we undo Western civilization? That was the problem that they were working on. So they turned to Freud. They wanted to know how to reinvigorate Marx, and they found the missing link in Freud. What does Freud have to do with anything? Well, Freud is just as dialectic. You see, there was the superego, and that corresponds with your conscience. And it's position related. It is thesis related. It says, this is, 2 + 2 = 4, my conscience, I think. That's my rational cognitive part of my being. And opposed to that is the id. That's where the feelings reside. It's just your impulses, your inner child. It's just spontaneous, impulsive feelings. And these two are in conflict with one another, right? If you feel something, your conscience always checks that and says, you better not. There's some Krispy Kremes in there. I know some of you went in there and went, your id said, ooh, Krispy Kremes, yum. And your conscience went, did you check your waistline lately? You shouldn't do that. I mean, so there's this conflict all the time. And Freud analyzed this, and he outlined this. And his solution was that you should compromise the conscience, because this conflict produces neuroses. And you stuff these things down in your personality, and they bubble up into other manifestations, other symptoms, neurotic symptoms. And the way to cure this was to go into therapy. And you went into this psychoanalysis process, and you know, he would help you identify things in your id. You had to get around your conscience. The conscience became an enemy. And so with this basic theorem, it armed the intellectuals from the Frankfurt School with the tool to undo, in their view, to undo Western civilization and prepare it for a Marxist revolution. These guys became very unpopular with traditional communists. Traditional communists, they would just walk in the room. If they didn't agree with you, they would shoot you. The transformational Marxists would come into the room and say, if you don't agree with them, really, how do you feel about that? What do you think? They would perform therapy on you. They would get rid of the conscience. Higher standards, accountability to higher authority is out. Here's Freud's couch. This is Freud's couch. It still exists today. It's in his house and it's in a museum. And somebody took a picture of it and I put it on my computer. And there it is. Looks nice and comfy. Have some big fluffy throw pillows. And Freud would take his patient in and lie him down. Nice and comfortable, nice and relaxed. And what would he do? How would he perform therapy? He was trying to liberate your feelings, trying to liberate your id. And he would explore things like your dreams or childhood experiences. Why? Because that's where the id had free reign. Children are just nothing but id. They're fun. Let's play. Boom. Let's go out and play. Throw the ball, swing. It's just childhood. And if he took you back in your childhood, you could explore and be sensitized to your feelings. Or dream analysis. What'd you have? You know, it never was the pizza you ate last night. It was always some great meaning to your dreams and things. But it was a ploy. It was to get to your id and to get around your conscience. Well, this was all fine and dandy. He was in Vienna at this time. I introduce another name for you, and that is J.L. Marino. J.L. Marino was yet another social psychologist. Very familiar with Freud, corresponded with Freud. And he said, Freud, you're doing it all wrong. He says, it's going to take forever to do the entire world on this couch. You know, we'll need armies of psychotherapists to do, you know, person after person, and it's lengthy and it's time consuming, and it takes a long time to get someone to where they're finally, I'm free of my conscience. He says, let's do it in the group. Let's get people together in a group. And then we'll just explore our id together through psychodrama and role-playing and doing this. We'll get people to perform this therapy on themselves within the group. And we'll multiply this group after group after group after group till the whole world does it. These guys from the Frankfurt School also borrowed from J.L. Marino's ideas as well. Part of the problem with Freud's theory was of the id. Is that he explained that the id was this seething cauldron, his words, seething cauldron of incest and murder and rape and just bad impulses. Now, it's kind of hard to sell the world that it's a great thing to let that out of the box. So later generations of humanist psychologists, and these are names that you're probably familiar with, Abraham Maslow and Carl Rogers, they had to clean Freud up a little bit and say, no, that's just for sick people. We all, us normal people, have, you know, the id is pure, it's good, let's let it out. And these guys planted the seeds. The Frankfurt School and these humanist psychologists, the 1960s came courtesy of these guys right here and the New Age movement subsequent to that. Well, let's turn again to Kurt Lewin. He was associated, not a member of, but associated with the Frankfurt School. Each one of these individuals played a major impact on American society and culture. So many of the artifacts that we have in our culture, the language that we use, advertising, the media, what we do in these group dynamics, meetings, it came from these guys. Adorno went to LA, influenced Hollywood tremendously. Lazarsfeld, again, in other communications. I don't have time for everybody, but what's germane for our discussion today is Kurt Lewin. Who was Kurt Lewin? He was a Gestalt psychologist. Gestalt is another word for holistic. You have to see everything together in its totality before you can really understand it. He moved to USA from Berlin with Karl Korsch, another major transformational Marxist. He continued his research at the University of Iowa, right in the heartland of our country. Major transformational Marxist, right smack dab in the Bible Belt. He then moved to MIT. MIT became a hotbed for this kind of thinking. The Institute for Social Research was reestablished there. And then the Institute for Social Research went to Michigan State University after his death. They were responsible for BSTEP, Behavior Science Teachers Education Program, which is the basis of all teacher training. And he helped set up the first national training laboratory in Bethel, Maine. They realized that they could not do these group dynamic meetings in a formal setting. They wanted to find someplace off base to give you a new environment to be in. But as that thing was getting fired up, he died unexpectedly. Let's understand. This is from his dynamic theory of personality. This is all stuff he did in the 20s and the 30s as a psychologist. Very important to understand. I tried to distill it and make it simple and to carry this idea further. He did lots of these kinds of experiments, always with children, then he moved them to the adult realm. Here we have three essential elements in this experiment. We have a piece of chocolate and a child. In between the two is this bench. And this is situated in an environment. See, these, remember, he's a gestalt psychologist. We have to look at the totality of the circumstances. There's going to be some psychic forces that happen within this environment. Let's take a look. This chocolate forms a positive force within the child's environment. It impels him to want. I mean, it's his id, is it not? Wow, chocolate, yum, I want. But there was something in the way, and that's the bench. It forms a negative valence, his word, valence, his force field. It is opposing the child. Right away, now that you guys are experts in the dialectic, you automatically see there is a dialectic relationship here going on. Dialectic causes change, according to these guys. Well, if I create this tension, I'm going to force the child to modify this environment. He labeled the positive force within the environment as play behavior, and the negative as barrier behavior. So play behavior and barrier behavior creates this frustration. I can't get to that chocolate. There's something holding me back. So he must do something. He must find a way around the barrier to get to the chocolate. Simple enough. This tension, this anxiety is a need. It's a felt need. It's a need to eliminate this anxiety, this tension that I feel. Abraham Maslow went to great pains, and this is a simplistic version of his hierarchy of felt needs. Breaks down into three categories. You have physical needs, right? Sleep, food, exercise, that sort of thing. The next level is social needs. Don't underestimate your social needs. You wouldn't have taken a shower, put on clean clothes, deodorant, you know, brushed your teeth this morning if you didn't care about your social needs. You don't want to walk in and offend everybody in the room. You want to be accepted, look nice, and well, it's very powerful. You'll starve. You'll neglect your physical needs. I mean, look at the anorexics. They'll starve themselves. They'll deprive themselves of physical needs so they can satisfy their social needs or their perceived social needs. Very powerful category there. And then at the top, self-actualization. That big word just means that you think you're God. Kurt Lewin said, when the child finds the solution of such a detour problem, I underline that because we're going to discuss problem solving. This is a detour problem. It happens by reason of a restructuring of the field. That child has to restructure something in his environment to satisfy his felt needs. To be governed by two strong goals, and we saw that, a barrier and a play behavior, is the equivalent to the existence of two conflicting controlling heads within the organism. Let me pause here for a moment. Doesn't it amaze you that there are human beings that study this stuff to this degree? I mean, I wouldn't give second thought to this stuff. But, I mean, they broke human behavior down to just the smallest quantum so they can control and to figure out how to manipulate. Their theories are foreign to us because we don't think that this stuff is that important, that you have to dissect it to such a degree. He called this cognitive or thinking dissonance. It's where we get the word dizzy. I get confused. It's this conflict between two heads, between barrier behavior and play behavior. And Kurt Lewin said, if I can control the environment that you are in, I can either increase or decrease the levels of cognitive dissonance, that conflict within your organism. Let's look at the dialectic. Let's just overlay Lewin's two-headed conflict over this little dialectic structure that I've got. Here is, you see the superego and the thesis and the conscience here. And he just merely relabeled Freud's terms. It's the same exact thing. Barrier behavior and the conscience are equivalent in Lewin's scheme. The id and the feelings are play behavior. Therapy for him, changing for him, wasn't necessarily compromising the conscience, although that's what it is. He called it the problem-solving process. See, if I relabel all these things, it sounds good. We're going to get into the problem-solving process. This concept, this should lead to a decrease in the degree of hierarchical organization. What does that mean? It means that your conscience tells your feelings what to do. I'm going to break that down until everything's kind of in flux. Your feeling, you don't know what's in charge, your feelings or your conscience. Also, a certain disorganization should result from the fact that the cognitive motor system loses to some degree its character of a good medium because of these conflicting hits. Excuse me? It just means that you get confused and you don't know what to do. He even had a term for it. He called it synesthesia. Synesthesia. When I synthesize the conscience and the feelings, I've anesthetized the conscience. I've just gave it some Novocaine. I don't feel my conscience anymore. It is usually easier, he said, to change individuals formed into a group than to change any one of them separately. So he's getting into this concept of group dynamics. He's going to utilize the fear of social rejection, also known as the use of alienation. He's going to use this idea of alienating you from other people in a group to cause this dissonance because you have social felt needs. He moved this concept into more advanced stages of group dynamics. This is a social group, and this is you in the social group. Instead of a chocolate bar and a kid and a bench, we've got group acceptance. No longer physical needs that I'm experimenting with. Now I'm moving up into the social felt needs category. I've got group acceptance that you want. And you're not even conscious of it. You walk into the room and you unconsciously want to relate with other people. And even if you say, oh, doesn't bother me, I like standing alone. We all do. We all are just, it's the way we're wired. Why? I don't know. Someday we can ask God, why did you wire us this way? Because it's our undoing many times. The fear of alienation is the positive force in that environment. It is our play behavior. It's unconscious. It's just we feel it without even thinking it. Opposite of that is our barrier. Our conscience is still with us as we walk into the room. It is a negative balance within that environment. And of course, if I control the environment, Kurt Lewin said, and I can produce cognitive dissonance, I can elicit this level of frustration. And you will make a choice between your feelings and your conscience. Usually, you will do it without thinking about it. And you will find a way around that barrier. Now it's not a bench, it's an internal barrier, isn't it? It's your conscience. Gosh, that thing, I resent it. We can sit here all day long and go, the Ten Commandments, we love them. I mean, we're Christians, right? But I mean, I can guarantee you that every day you go through and at least in your heart resent at least one or more of those Ten Commandments. We may venerate them, but sometimes our feelings, you know, they're so strong. I mean, it's the way it is. So he knows that. Even though we cherish those barriers within us, read Romans chapter 7 and watch the Apostle Paul go through this agony. I want to do this, but I don't do that. The things I want to do, I don't do. It's this conflict. It's this process. These guys figured it out. Put it into a laboratory. But don't worry, you're not the only one doing it. Everybody else in the group is driving for this group unity. So, this is Kurt Lewin's group problem-solving process. A successful change, therefore, includes three aspects. Unfreezing. How do we unfreeze? I create the dissonance. That unfreezes you from your set way of thinking. Unfreezing the present level, moving it to the new level. This is where the dialogue comes in, and we move to this new level of consensus, this new level of unity, and then freezing group life on the new level. Eve went through the same process. She was in the garden, hanging out by a tree that she shouldn't have. She's by this forbidden object. The fruit came with a warning label, didn't it? Surgeon General's warning. In the day that you shall eat thereof, you will surely die. There was a barrier there to that desired forbidden fruit. It wasn't external. It was in here. God put it in her conscience. Don't do it. There's a barrier. There's a boundary. Don't cross it. There was a facilitator in that room. He helped her become dissatisfied with what is. That was conscious. That was position. That's is. It was a fact. In the day that you eat of it, you will die. It's a fact. And Satan dialogued with her. And he got her to start to question what is. Did he really say that? A woman has needs, don't you know? Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Physical needs, social needs, self-actualization needs. Well, she saw that it was good for food, that it was pleasing to look at, and able to make one wise, the scriptures say. This is what she was going through. Give Abe Maslow credit, right? He put into scientific terms all the corruption that's in the world. The corruption that's in the world? Yeah, 1 John. He said the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. That's all the corruption that's in the world. She didn't bite on one. She didn't bite on two. She bit on all three. And she had a decision to make. Barrier behavior or play behavior? Which do I choose? Cognitive dissonance. Oh my gosh, what am I going to do? Boy, I can be like God if I have that thing. I can be like him. She found a way around that barrier to the forbidden object. Kurt Lewin would say that she became the world's first problem solver. He had a special label for this. I want to introduce it now without explaining too much. Problem-solving process. This whole thing I just described consisted of four elements: data collection, diagnosis, action, evaluation. Don't worry about it. I'll come back to this. He called it action research. One of the problems, he said, how to freeze. Remember, unfreeze, move to the new level, and freeze at the new level. How do we freeze it? That became a problem. How do we freeze it at the new level? Let's move from a didactic, facts-based, conscious-based, what is, what's reality? How do we move into this dialectic realm where all is in flux, all is in change, all is evolving? He said one of the fundamental problems of action research or problem solving, namely, how to change group conduct. How to change group conduct, that's the goal, not solving problems, changing group conduct, so that it would not slide back to the old level within a short time. We get these people in groups we've observed. They go through this process, but once they go back home, once they go back to this other environment, they go back to this old way of doing things. They go back to a hierarchical, patriarchal mindset. Well, if they leave this environment to another environment, the key is we must change the environment everywhere. It's the goal of the transformational Marxist to reshape every environment that you're in. School, work, home, the media, everywhere you go, you will not escape this process. The Planning of Change by Warren Bennis. Kenneth Benet worked with Lewin in the National Training Labs. He said this in here. He said, organizational cultures must be changed to reinforce and maintain changes achieved by individuals. Not only do we have to get these people in the groups, but we got this additional problem. The structure of the organizations they're in, their churches, their home, all the ones I just described, they have to change as well. The structure of the organization has to become dialectic. So we must change the environment to reinforce the changes that are made. Mr. McGregor was also at MIT. This was the first effort to redefine how organizations are structured. And he just called it Theory X and Theory Y. We've got Theory X, and that is traditional, authoritarian, bureaucratic, patriarchal, and repressive. It is bad and evil. That's Theory X. That's what must be changed. That's the way things are now. We must move to Theory Y. This is transformational, democratic, efficient, matriarchal, and liberating. What does patriarchal mean? Patriarchal is literally the rule of the father. In concept, it just means you're accountable to a higher authority. Matriarchal is the rule of the mother. That's relational. There is no higher authority. So we must change the organization to be relational. We must all get together and just hug. This is good and pure. It had some problems, but it went through evolution, but it was the basis for all, ladies and gentlemen, all organizational structures today. You cannot go to a business school today and learn anything but this process. This is how to structure your organization, large and small, to be successful. And it's based on. It was McGregor who's the one who brought Kurt Lewin to MIT in 1946, and until his death 18 years later, McGregor built upon Lewin at every turn. Now he's taken the group concept, he's trying to solve Kurt Lewin's freezing problem. Let's change the organization. Here are some of the characters. Kenneth Benet, probably the lead character in the National Training Labs after Kurt Lewin's death. Here they are after one of these group dynamics meetings. They're still working this stuff out. They get together in these groups and they observe them. These are all social psychologists, by the way. And they're arguing. They went into excruciating detail, just like Kurt Lewin did, on what type of personalities do what in a group and how to neutralize them and how to encourage the type of personalities in that group to get the effects that you want. It was literally the Manhattan Project of how to undo a society, of how to undo a culture and to transform them. One of the main works that came out of their efforts was Human Relations and Curriculum Change. It was a distillation of all their observations and what they found during all these experiments in group dynamics. It is literally a cookbook for human beings. And the agenda is right in the title, Human Relations. It's how to remove everything that's within a room so human relationship can flourish. Now, of course, as the lower part of the title is curriculum change, it was initially targeted for schools. But as you'll see that it has just branched out into every facet of society. This was initially published in bulletin form in 1948, in book form in 1951. You thought it was something new. You thought you got together in groups and dialogued to consensus. It's over 50 years old, 60 years old now. This could be the San Diego Police Department. We don't do anything unless it looks like that. We're going to move to a new office. We got to get together in a group and discuss everything. We're going to change the color of our pins on our uniform. We got to get together in a group and debate it and dialogue it. It's just on and on and on. This is the group dynamics model. It is a diverse group. You know what diversity means. It is necessary for dialectic conflict. They dialogue to consensus with feelings. You debate facts. You debate your conscience. You dialogue to consensus. Okay? It's over a social problem. You have to have, doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't matter what it is. Is the bridge out? You got a leaky roof? Is there graffiti in the neighborhood? Pick a problem, any problem. Because it's not the problem that we're solving. We're solving you. We're solving your problem. Problem of your conscience. It's led by a facilitator. This thing can't function properly unless it's guided by a facilitator. Back then they called them a change agent. The word evolved into a facilitator because it's not as dramatic as change agent. Hi, I'm your change agent. Your guard goes up. But if I say, hi, I'm your friendly facilitator, it sounds, the defenses don't go up. And it's to a predetermined outcome. They know where they're headed with this before they even start. You think you're having a good old time doing all these exercises and going through these gyrations. The outcome is predetermined in advance. It is merely a Soviet. A Soviet is merely a group. The Soviet Union was a union of groups led by, ostensibly, the Supreme Soviet at the top. The Soviet Union always advertised itself as a democratic country. We're all going to get together into groups and come to a consensus democratically. And these ideas would boil to the top, and the Supreme Soviet would lead by the will of the people. Did it actually work out that way? No. It was dictatorial from the top down. This is an illusion. They promise you the moon, and they deliver hell. The National Training Labs, they're still in existence today. They claim to have trained well over 200,000 people have gone through there, including ministers, police personnel, leaders in government. 200,000 people, 200,000 change agents. That's a lot of people going out into their respective places of influence. It's not just some freaks over in the corner that are just misfits at the fringe of society. This is what we are doing. And even today, they say on their website, training in theory and practice. Theory and practice, you know that by now, is a Marxist concept. Philosophers have only interpreted the world. They've only theorized about the world. The point, however, is to change it. Bring theory, the dialectic, closer to practice. We need to practice the dialectic. Theory and practice. Training in theory and practice of group dynamics, organizational change, and societal change. They're not shy. I mean, they're telling you what they're doing. This is 50-some years later, today. And this isn't about money. It's about big money. It's about, they charge up to $10,000 to take one class. One class, $10,000, $11,000 for some. In 1961, the Human Relations and Curriculum Change was updated to the Planning of Change. And in that book, they say, looking back at their experiences, we may use the organization of the National Training Labs in 1947 as a milestone in the development of normative, re-educative approaches to changing in America. I take a breath there because normative re-education, there's another one of these words. Normative re-education, we're just going to re-educate your norms. Like those Ten Commandments, those are norms. God says, these are my norms for you to operate on. And we're going to re-educate them. Re-educate, that sounds, I'm going to re-education has a positive tone. re-educate you. And this is their technique for changing in America. And they lay it out. They had three basic categories: rational empirical approach to change, a normative re-educative mode of changing, and power coercive. On the far right, you've got revolutionaries like Marx. They throw them in here because it's important. And then on the far left, it's education and science and the media. But they favor the normative re-educative approach to changing in America. It's like a family tree. Who did what? They're thinking. And they lay it out. It's charted. There's Freud and Marino, John Dewey, Carl Rogers, Kurt Lewin, Eric Trist of England, Abraham Maslow, we mentioned him, B.F. Skinner, How to Train Rats. He bragged that I can make a pigeon a high performer simply by conditioning his reflexes. And of course, his Skinnerian techniques are used in the classroom today, how to condition kids. Warren Bennis of the National Training Labs, McGregor, we mentioned him, Theory X, Theory Y. Rensis Likert, didn't talk about him today. Kenneth Binet, Conflict Labs, the National Training Labs, problem solving method, there it is again. Sensitivity in T groups, group psychotherapy of institutions, but it's all leading to one basic thing, and that is at the bottom of the page, they are strategies of deliberate changing. The goal is to change. And even in all their detailed works, they never tell you exactly what we're changing from to what we're changing to. But I am. As they said it right in here, many of Marx's values would have put him behind what we call normative re-educative strategies of changing. These convictions led Lewin to emphasize action research as a strategy of changing and participation in groups as a medium of re-education. I couldn't put it in a more succinct sentence. These convictions of problem solving, they are in reality a strategy of changing. They're doing this for homeschoolers as well. How to teach your kid to be a good problem solver. It's a curriculum to take you through the dialectic process. Participation in groups as a medium of re-education. Very important concept. One of the most important slides I have in here. So problem solving is a means of social change. They also credit Freud. He contributed two main points to normative re-education. This is important to understand as well. Therapy. Freud's whole gig was therapy as a means to free the id, and they acknowledge that. Well, he was, as the psychoanalyst, he was a therapist. But now in these normative re-educative strategies of changing, the therapist now is considered a change agent, and that word was later changed to a facilitator. And the patient, we have a patient-therapist relationship. So now, when I say change agent client, I'm still talking about a therapeutic method, a therapeutic ideal. It's that relationship. The facilitator comes in as a therapist. You are going through therapy when you participate in these groups. I have a missile here. What does this have to do with what we're talking about today? There was a problem in weapons development during World War II. Battle environment was becoming much too rapid for your basic human operator to target things. Things were becoming much greater distances. Planes were dropping things from thousands, tens of thousands of feet. Ships were very far away. Planes were moving really fast. And became difficult to engineer weapons systems to find their target in an efficient manner. A human being was no longer, we got the difference today between smart bombs and dumb bombs, right? In World War II, we just had nothing, and prior to that, we had dumb bombs. We had dumb spears and dumb arrows and dumb weapons, right? Once they left the human operator, once they left the human warrior, the combatant, we had no control over it. It went about where we hoped it would, and that was about the best we could do. The weapon had no ability to correct itself if it was deviating from a target. They turned to these electrical engineers at MIT, and they said, "We've got this problem. How can you resolve it?" They were already working with this idea of systems dynamics or systems thinking, and it went something like this: any system, including a weapon system, is a process. Even a simple or complex, it is a system process, and it consists of certain elements. You have inputs into that system, and you have outputs. For example, if I had a dumb bomb, a dumb rocket, let's say, and I could aim it at a target, I would have certain inputs. I would put the warhead, I'd put fuel, I'd put whatever it needed to operate. Those were inputs. And then the system would, if it was an engine or something, it would process those inputs, and then it would have some kind of an output, simply. It would have a behavior. It was goal-oriented. It wanted to go to a target. Now, the problem that they were faced with was, how do we keep this thing on track? What if the ship moves? What if the plane takes evasive maneuvers? What if you can't even see it? It's over the horizon. How can we get this thing? We had to add one more element to this process, and it was called a feedback loop. In other words, I had to give my weapon eyes and ears. So if it was off course, it could detect it and make corrections. In other words, it got feedback from its environment, so it could correct for deviations. There was another element that's part of this, and it's called a feed forward. The thing needs a brain. It needs to process not only physical stuff like fuel and that sort of thing, it needs a brain to process what? Information. What does this have to do with anything? Well, remember, Kurt Lewin and this gang, they were all at MIT at the same time. And when this came along, Kurt Lewin looked at this and went, bingo. This is a perfect, I can use this not only for machines, I can use it for human beings. I can use it for social systems. Now, Norbert Wiener was the guy that is credited with cooking up the system, and he called it cybernetics. Cyber is from the Greek word meaning a tiller or a steerage, a rudder, and it just means I can steer. If I add a feedback loop to this process, I can steer it. I can control whatever system I'm dealing with. And this went into various other applications. It became the basis for communications theory and that sort of thing. That's why we ended up calling cyber this and cyber that in connection with computers. This is also the basis of total quality management. That's why I introduced this concept the way I do. They moved it from mere machines, which is fine. It's a very applicable system. Systems engineers use this all the time to design systems. But these guys said, let's apply it to human beings. Total quality management. In my research, trying to figure out what total quality management was all about, you keep coming across Ed Deming. He's supposed to be the father of TQM. He isn't really. And all the books that he talks about total quality management don't do a quality job of explaining what it is. It rambles, it's very vague, and it's just a lot of sugar-coated stuff. And then it came across a presentation that he made shortly before his death in 1992 to a group of educators. And he says, if you really want to understand total quality management, he says, read the works of two men, Peter Senge and Irvin Laszlo. I'll spare you Peter Senge's stuff because there'll be some presentations that include him. But so I will, you'll hear, if you do your own research on total quality management, don't get sidetracked on Ed Deming. He's worthless to understand total quality management, even though he's credited with founding it. So anyway, I went to Irvin Laszlo, and I started reading his materials, got every book he wrote, and it was very enlightening. He traces his own philosophical development through Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Hegel, Marx, others. He is very dialectic in his thinking, and this is what he had to say in reference to this systems thinking. Feedback thought. Remember, when you see the word feedback, you're thinking systems dynamics. Feedback thought in social science. Laszlo said this, the dialectic of Hegel and Marx's variation on the theme contained discrepancies between actual and desired conditions. Where have we heard that language before? The actual is what is it not? And the desired is what ought to be. The contradiction between thesis and antithesis set up pressures that eventually force a new state of affairs, the synthesis. The desired condition of synthesis is the elimination of contradiction and conflict between thesis and antithesis. Conflict between thesis and antithesis bring about a restructuring or a change that reduces or eliminates, negates the conflict. There's negation of negation. So he, in one paragraph there, explains that systems thinking is just as dialectic as Marx and Hegel's. Why? You'll see it as we go along. So here's your organization. Let's overlay McGregor's concept of theory X and theory Y. Your organization, whether it's your church or work or whatever, theory X is authoritarian, traditional, patriarchal, and theory Y is democratic, transformational, and matriarchal. Its thesis, its actual, it's what is. Remember what Laszlo just said. Theory Y is antithesis. It's what's desired. It's what ought to be. And the conflict between these two, produce change in your organization. You receive inputs. Your organization is as is. It receives inputs from who? Receives inputs from a change agent, internal or external. And then, because the change agent says, well, it ought to be this way. We should do it that way. We ought to be able to do it that way. And it produces, this conflict produces dialectic change. Kurt Lewin said it's the creation of permanent change. Laszlo wrote several books. The Goals for Mankind, this was a report to the Club of Rome, a New Age organization that boasts of many, many leaders of the world. This was his Goals for Mankind. Again, that's outputs. What should be the total system? This is all systems thinking now. His other book, Choice, Evolution or Extinction, A Thinking Person's Guide to Global Issues. If you don't think his way, I guess you're not a thinking person. Now, again, a fringe element? No. The afterword is by Frederico Mayer, at the time the Director General of UNESCO. This is the philosophy of the United Nations. They view the world along these lines. They view the world as a social system, the entire globe. What you have here is this wheel, double wheel looking thing in the center of the screen. On the left, the globe, the orb that you see, is actually the sun. And the arrow pointing is inputs to the system. The world, the globe is seen, the world is a system. The upper level is human society, and the lower level is the environments, the natural resources of the world. So the sun has inputs energy, raw energy, to the world system. It is processed, system process, through nature, right? It grows things, oil, trees, and all these raw materials. Human society, there's feedback loops within the system, and the human society draws on the natural environment, processes them. You have waste products, and you have products and behaviors and stuff, and then you have waste heat that's exhausted and outputs on the other side. So you've got a systems dynamic model of the earth here, according to Laszlo. Here's another version. But anyway, this is it's a cell. It's a single cell. And the single cell has components within it. And at the far upper left, you see a local system. It's the smallest little subsystem that's within the cell. Then above that, you have a larger system containing the local. It's the neighborhood system. You have a subnational system, which is then enclosed in a larger component. That's the national system. The regional system, again, is a larger unit. And then you've got encompassed the line around the whole thing is the world system. They view the world as a living organism that's evolving. In fact, they call it Gaia. It's Mother Earth. It's the ancient Greek goddess for Earth. So it's not just a concept. They look at this in a pagan Greek mythological sense. Mother Earth is to be worshipped, and she is a living organism. It's not just a dead thing. That's one way that Laszlo uses to illustrate that it's a system of subsystems. Here's another important individual, Jay Forrester, also of MIT, very instrumental in this thing. Probably wouldn't exist in the form that it does if it wasn't for him. A systems thinker, wrote several books, Industrial Dynamics, a lot of technical stuff, but he also was another globalist, was associated with Laszlo, and here is his book. I think this is out of Industrial Dynamics. And you see all these boxes, and they've got labels and lines connecting them all. This is a depiction of the world charted out with all of its feedback loops. And here it is labeled the structure of the world system. Now, he wrote a book called Limits to Growth, based on these kind of theories. And Limits to Growth discusses these things. You've got population, economy, natural resources, pollution, the food supply. And what's going to happen is as population increases, it feeds back throughout the rest of the system. And food supply is going to fall. And pollution is going to go up. And natural resources are going to be depleted. The economy is going to crash. Ah, it's all doomsday, right? Based on the systems model. They never abandoned this idea. Well, here is Maurice Strong, chairman of the Earth Council, chairman of the United Nations University for Peace, and advisor to the UN Secretary General, very influential person. These appointed people come and go from the UN. People like him stay. He's been there, seems like, forever. He's a billionaire out of Canada, one of the most powerful men in the world. He has a place outside of Pagosa Springs, a big ranch out there. He's got a New Age temple that you can go and worship in if you're invited. You just don't walk off the street. He wrote several things. This is Where on Earth Are We Going? This is his depiction of the world system. Now, it doesn't look like a bunch of feedback loops. It's color-coded on the right, and it's a Security Council, the upper assembly, the first lower assembly, transnational bodies, region states, all the way down to the yellow is communities. So this is a world system. And notice that it's drawn in such a way that it's all interconnected. It all has its various feedback loops. And one component of that cannot escape from another component. It's all together. This is the Politburo system. It is the Soviet on a global scale, because the communities get in their groups, the regional system on up, all the way up to the Security Council at the top. This is a signed copy. This little sheet here is from Redirection, A Sustainable Future, courtesy of Joan Vian, good friend of mine. She gave me a copy of this. She got Maurice Strong to sign off on it. Likes going to UN meetings and things and sticking microphones in people's faces and asking them, why are you taking over the world? I got this from one of my partners at work. He was going to San Diego State. He was getting his master's in administration, right? That's all you get. This is from the book Visions of Organization. It has the systems model. Inputs coming in from the left, the organizational subsystems, which is, you can't see, but I'll read it to you. This circle encompasses the strategic subsystem, the technological subsystem, the structural subsystem, which is just like the buildings and the cars and stuff that you have. And this is the most important one that we have to be worried about, and that is the human cultural subsystem. And overlaying them all in the center is the managerial system. That's the brain of this thing. When the managerial system thinks, all the other subsystems move. Just like you are a system of subsystems. You've got liver and heart and kidneys and all these things. And all these subsystems work in coordination to the brain, the managerial subsystem. And that's how the UN thinks of itself, as a living organism. And when the UN Security Council thinks, they expect you to act. Maybe not now, but in the future. Organizations, like organisms, can be conceived of as sets of interacting subsystems. These subsystems can be defined in many ways. Here's one example. But this one is important for us. It's the human cultural subsystem. And this is the one that's subject to all of this human engineering, all this group dynamics stuff, because it has to conform. The individual is a system of subsystems. The individual is a subsystem within the group, and the group all the way up through the national to the supranational systems, they envision the globe as a system to be controlled cybernetically. And in The Aquarian Conspiracy, by Marilyn Ferguson, Personal Social Transformation for the 1980s, this is the Bible for the New Age movement, she talks about quantity to quality, general systems theory, cybernetics, dialectic transformation, and finally, by the last chapter, she's telling you, you have the God within, because this is what it is. It's a very Gnostic structure. It is the New Age movement. This is E. Coleman. He was a Soviet philosopher. The Soviets picked up on this immediately, and this is what he had to say. The goal of our development is what? Communist society. It is a complex system. Ooh, communist society is a complex system. This is dialectic and systems theory married. And from the point of view of cybernetics is an open dynamic one with ideal self-regulation. Since as a whole, it has at its disposal the feedback of its numerous subsystems, it compensates automatically for the deviations from the state of dynamic equilibrium. For all that is necessary that the system and all of its subsystems function according to an optimal program. What is the program? It's the dialectic. It's dialectical materialism. If you deviate from that optimal program, you must be re-educated. You must be remediated. You must be reprocessed. You're just human resources. You must just go back through the system, fed back through the system until you get it right or you are processed out. Ed Deming said in Total Quality Management, he says, variation is the enemy of quality. Now, if you're making ball bearings or bottle caps or something, that's fine, because you want them exactly perfect every time. You don't want variations in the quality. if I look at this and go, this is a quality computer, it means it's free from defects. But that's not the quality they're talking about. They're talking about the horsetail kind of quality, the overall everything, the global, how everything interrelates with one another. Variation, in that sense, is the enemy. You walk into the room, and you have standards, you have norms and values that are different than dialectical materialism, the dialectic, you are the enemy of the system. There is no deviation. If you deviate, you must be re-educated. And for a Christian, that spells persecution.